but with only Vaynandakatra to face, I think it can be done, provided we get access to gunpowder weapons. There are cannons in Supara, said the Maratha officer, Shaji. If we take the city, we will take them also.
Not enough, grunted Kungus. Not by themselves.
He looked at Holker.
You have spies in Supara. If I'm not mistaken, those cannons are fixed siege guns.
Holker nodded.
They're huge bombards. Three of them positioned to defend the city against seaborne attack.
He grimaced.
I suppose they could be moved, but...
Forget it, interrupted Kungus. We can use those cannons to defend Supara against the Malwa fleet, but they'll be no use to us in a land war against Vaynandakatra's army. For that, we need help from the Romans. By now, I'm quite sure Belisarius has developed a Roman capacity to produce gunpowder weapons. If we can establish contact with him, the Ethiopians could smuggle the weapons to us and keep us supplied with gunpowder.
Everyone in the cabin exchanged glances.
We need to send a mission to Rome, then, said Bindusara.
Not to Rome, demurred Dadaji. To Belisarius. To the Roman government, we are simply bizarre outlanders. Only Belisarius knows us well.
The Peshwa straightened his posture.
I will go, he announced.
Our delegation must be led by someone who is both highly placed in the Empress's government and personally known to Belisarius.
I am the obvious choice.
Nonsense, exclaimed Shakuntala. The idea is utterly mad. You are my Peshwa, Dadaji. I need you to remain here.
Holker frowned. But I am the only one who...
He broke off, casting a startled glance at Kungus. The Kushan commander huffed. Coming from someone else, the noise would have been interpreted as humor. Coming from Kungus, it was hard to tell.
He is the commander of your bodyguard, protested Dadaji.
Shakuntala waved her hand.
He is not needed in that capacity anymore. Kanishka is more than capable of taking his place. Actually, his talents are being wasted there.
Everyone in the room was staring at Kungus. The expression on the faces of most of the Indians was a mixture of skepticism and hesitation.
Shaji cleared his throat.
If you will forgive me, Your Majesty, it seems to me that sending Kungus might be a bad idea. He is not of noble blood, neither Brahmin nor Kshatriya, and I fear the Roman general Belisarius might be offended if your ambassador were of such a low...
The rest of the sentence was lost, buried beneath an eruption of laughter. Coming from the Ethiopians, mainly, but the Empress herself was participating, and even Kungus emitted a chuckle or two. Dadaji simply smiled, and said, shaking his head,
You don't understand, Shaji. Romans in general, and Belisarius in particular, don't look at these things the way we Indians do. They are punctilious about the forms of nobility, but as to its real content...
He shrugged.
So long as Kungus is the official envoy of the Empress and carries with him a sufficiently resounding title, the Romans will be quite satisfied.
Certainly Belisarius will.
Excellent point, Dadaji, stated Shakuntala. She bestowed an imperial nod upon Kungus.
I hereby appoint you my ambassador to Rome and give you the titles of Mahedandanayaka and Badasvabadi.
Kungus's incipient smile surfaced. Barely.
Great Commandant and Lord of Army and Cavalry, he murmured. Aye, now I've risen in the world.
Catching a glimpse of Garmat's face, Shakuntala turned to him. The Ethiopian advisor's gaiety had quite vanished, replaced by a frown.
You disagree, she stated.
There was no accusation in the words, simply a question. The old half-Arab stroked his beard.
Yes, Empress, I do.
He made a dismissive gesture with his hand.
Not, of course, for the reasons advanced earlier. Kungus would be quite acceptable as an ambassador from the Roman point of view, more than acceptable as far as Belisarius is concerned. The general trusts and admires the man deeply. I know, he told me so himself.
The Indian officers in the cabin moved their eyes to Kungus. As ever, the Kushan commander's face was impassive, like a mask. But they were reminded again that the unprepossessing Kushan, whom they tended unconsciously to regard as a low-born half-barbarian, enjoyed a reputation among the greatest folk of their world which was far beyond their own.
What's the problem, then? Asked Shakuntala.
Garmat pursed his lips.
The problem, Empress, is threefold.
He held up a thumb.
First, you'll be sending off one of your most capable military commanders on the very eve of a decisive battle. Zipporah can be taken, I believe, despite its guns, but doing so, as we've discussed before, will depend on the Kushans seizing the cannons by a surprise assault. Until they do so, you cannot think to land in Zipporah itself with your Maratha cavalry. The ships would be destroyed before they reach the docks.
He pointed at Kungus.
If I were you, that is the man I would want leading that attack. No other.
Shakuntala was shaking her head. Garmad held up a hand, forestalling her words.
No, Empress, you cannot wait until after the battle to send Kungus away. There is no time to lose if you want to get Roman help. I myself must leave this expedition tomorrow to report back to the Negus Nagast. Your ambassador, whoever it is, should accompany me on that ship.
Shakuntala bowed her head, thinking. As always, the young Empress was quick to decide.
I agree. We are pressed for time.
She raised her eyes.
The other reasons?
Garmad held up a finger alongside his thumb.
Second, I think Kungus's mission would be futile. How will he find Belisarius in that chaos in Persia?
The Ethiopian chuckled dryly.
It would be hard enough to find anyone, much less Belisarius. The general told me once that he considered the chaos of war to be his best friend. And there is always an advantage to be found, he told me, if you seize it in a willing embrace. Do you understand what that means?
Shakuntala's Maratha officers were frowning, as was the Empress herself. All of them, it was clear, found the notion of treasuring war's confusion bizarre. But Kungus, understanding, nodded his head.
Melisarius will be riding the whirlwind, he said. He will do everything in his power to create chaos and then take advantage of it.
The Kushan rubbed the topknot on his head.
He not only could be anywhere, he will be doing everything he can to make it seem as if he were one place while he's going somewhere else.
He grunted, partly with admiration, partly with chagrin.
The intention, of course, is to confuse the enemy, but it will have the same effect on allies trying to find him.
The topknot rubbing grew vigorous.
It will be difficult. Difficult.
It will be impossible, countered Garmad. And finally, quite unnecessary.
He waited for those last words to register before raising another finger.
My third reason, Empress, is simple. There is no need to send Kungus as an ambassador to Rome for the simple reason that I am quite sure Rome and Belisarius are sending an ambassador to you. That ambassador, I am certain, will be bringing what you need.
Everyone stared at Garmad. The surprise was obvious on all faces except those of the other Ethiopians.
You know something, stated Holker.
Nothing specific, said Ezana. Only, Garmad cleared his throat.
The Kingdom of Aksum has maintained a small but quite effective espionage service in the Roman Empire for well over a century now.
He made a small, half-apologetic grimace.
There has been no trouble between us and Rome, mind you. Ever since the Roman Emperor Diocletian set Elephantine as the southern limit of Roman territory in Africa, the border has been quite tranquil. Still,
he shrugged.
Rome is a great empire. Ours is much smaller. It always behooves a less powerful kingdom to keep an eye on its more powerful neighbor, regardless of their current intentions or attitudes. You never know, things might change.
The Indians in the room all nodded. Common sense, that. And they had their own memories of the long and turbulent history of India.
Most of our attention, naturally, is given to their province of Egypt. There we have the advantage that most of the population is Monophysite. Our own creed is very similar, and many of the Egyptian Monophysites look upon us as their religious brethren. Any number of Monophysite religious leaders have taken refuge in Ethiopia over the years, whenever the Orthodox persecution became...
He broke off, seeing the incomprehension in the faces of the Indians. Only Dadaji Holkar, he realized, understood anything of what he was saying. Garmad had to restrain himself from muttering,
"Damned arrogant Indians."
"Never mind," he sighed.
For all that he genuinely liked and admired many Indians, Garmad was struck again by their peculiar insularity. Even the most broad-minded Indians, with a few exceptions like Holkar, tended to look on the whole vast world beyond their own culture as an undifferentiated mass of semi-barbarians. The divisions within Christianity were quite beyond their ken or interest. "The point is this," he drove on. "We discovered some time ago that the Roman Empress is sending a military and political expedition to Egypt. The official purpose of that expedition is to quell an incipient rebellion and re-establish tight imperial control over their richest province. But who did they send to command this force? Belisarius's own wife, Antonina." He shrugged. "We're speculating, of course, but knowing Belisarius, I think the speculation is quite sound. Antonina's expedition is real enough on its own terms, of course. The Romans do need to keep a firm hand on Egypt. But we are quite sure that there is another purpose hidden within that public objective. We think Belisarius is sending his own wife in order to open a second front against the Malwa. It would be astonishing to us if that strategy did not include providing support for Andra." He gave Shakuntala and Holker a quick, knowing glance. The young empress and her Peshwa, understanding, nodded in reply. In order to maintain her prestige, Shakuntala had never publicly explained where she obtained the large fortune which served as her imperial war chest. Her Maratha officers, who rallied to her after her escape from Malwa, had never even thought to ask. Empresses are rich, everyone knows that. It's a law of nature. In reality, the hunted young girl had been given that treasure by Belisarius himself on the eve of her escape. The vast treasure with which Empress Gundagupta had tried to bribe Belisarius into treason, the Roman general had turned over to Shakuntala in order to finance a rebellion in Malwa's rear. "Would that man have forgotten you?" asked Garmat quietly. "Would that man not have continued to develop his plans?" Shakuntala's eyes widened slightly. "You're right," she whispered. "He is sending someone to us. Belisarius has thought of it already." Her shoulders slumped just a bit. From relief, it was obvious. It suddenly dawned on everyone how hard a decision it had been for her to send Kungus away. "You will stay, Kungus," she announced. "You will stay here, with me." The Kushan commander nodded. Then, with a sly little smile, murmured, "How quickly fortune passes." Shakuntala frowned fiercely. "Nonsense. I did not remove your titles, except that of ambassador to Rome. You are still Mahidandanayaka, still my Bhattasvapati." Her eyes softened, gazing on the man who had once been her captor, and always her protector. "As you have been since Amaravati," she whispered, "when you saved me from the Yetai beasts." Later, as they filed out of the cabin, the Maratha commander Shaji remarked to Garmat, "I wonder who the Romans are sending to us. A general of renown, no doubt." Fighting down a smile, Garmat made no reply. He glanced at Ezana and Wasi and saw that his two Ethiopian compatriots were fighting the same battle. Shaji moved on. "Poor fellow," murmured Wasi. "What a shock when he discovers," agreed Ezana. Now Garmat found himself fighting down an outright laugh. Ezana and Wasi had accompanied him 3 years earlier in his mission to Rome. They knew the realities of the Roman court. They knew the Empress Theodora's foibles. But he said nothing. Not until after the three Ethiopians had clambered into their small skiff and begun the trip back to their own ship. Only then did he burst into laughter. Ezana and Wasi joined him in that gaiety. "It's bound to be a woman," choked out Ezana. "Theodora wouldn't trust anyone else," gasped Wasi. "Shaji'll die of horror." Garmat shook his head. "That's not fair, actually. He's Maratha, don't forget. They recognize the legitimacy of female rulers. They even have a tradition of women leading armies. Still..." He fell silent. He wasn't sure, of course. It was pure speculation. But he thought he could guess who Theodora and Belisarius would send. Not Antonina. Garmat was quite sure that Belisarius had bigger plans for her. Of the Empress Theodora's inner circle of advisors, female advisors, that left only... Ezana completed the thought aloud. "They may have those traditions, Garmat," he chuckled, "but not even the Maratha have a tradition of sarcastic, quick-tongued, rapier-witted women who've read more books than they even knew existed." "Poor Shaji," concluded Wasi. "He's such a stiff and proper sort. I foresee chagrin in his future."
great discomfiture.
Chapter 22. The Eastern Mediterranean. Summer, 531 AD.
Be careful, hissed Antonina. I am being careful, growled Irene. It's the stupid boat that's being careless.
Hesitantly, gingerly, the spymaster stuck out her foot again, groping for the rail of the little skiff bobbing alongside Antonina's flagship. The sea was not particularly rough, but Irene's experience with climbing down a large ship into a smaller one was exactly nil. Her foot touched the rail, pressed down, skidded aside. Frantically, she clutched the rope ladder. A stream of vulgar curses ensued. Coarse phrases, unrefined terms, aimed at the world in general, and boats in particular. Above, Usanas grinned down.
Witness, everyone, a miracle. There is a book which Irene has never read after all. I refer, of course, to the On the Transfer of Personnel from Craft to Craft at Sea by the famous author Profanities of Dyspepsia.
A stream of really vulgar curses ensued. Utterly obscene phrases, incredibly gross terms, aimed exclusively at one particular African. The African in question grinned even wider.
May I lend you a hand? He asked pleasantly.
Irene glared up at him furiously.
Yes, she snarled. Get me into this stupid fucking boat.
No problem, noble Greek lady, said Usanas cheerfully.
The Dawaz leapt onto the rail of Antonina's flagship, gauged the matter for perhaps a microsecond, and sprang directly down into the boat below. He landed lightly on his feet, easily finding his balance, then turned to face Irene. The spymaster was swinging against the hull of the larger ship above him. Her face was pale, the knuckles of her hands clutching the rope ladder were white as snow.
Jump, he said.
Irene's eyes widened. She stared down at him as if ogling a dangerous lunatic.
Jump,
repeated Usanas.
I will catch you.
You're completely insane, she shrieked.
Usanas glanced up at the flagship above. Antonina and Aeon were both leaning over the rail. Antonina's face was filled with deep concern. Aeon's with a struggle to contain his laughter.
Aeon,
shouted Usanas.
Cut the ladder.
Good idea, boomed Aeon.
The prince drew his blade from its baldric. It was a typical Aximite sword, other than being more finely made than most, which is to say it was short, square-tipped, and very heavy, more like a huge cleaver than a Roman spatha. Irene's terrified eyes stared up at the thing. The sword would obviously cut through the thin ropes of the ladder like an axe. Aeon, muscled like a Hercules, raised the blade high.
Oh!
She screamed, and then, convulsively, let go of the ladder. She fell no more than 4 feet. Usanas caught her easily. Then, neatly, set her upright on the deck of the skiff. An instant later, she collapsed into a pile of cordage coiled in the bilge.
You are a foul creature, she hissed, from a foul land.
Gasp, gasp. Now I know where Homer got the inspiration for the Cyclops. Usanas clucked his tongue.
So cruel, he complained. So vicious.
From above came Antonina's voice.
Are you all right, Irene?
The spymaster took a deep, shuddering breath, then suddenly burst into a smile.
I'm quite fine, actually. The first mission is accomplished.
She transferred the smile onto Usanas.
I apologize for my insulting and intemperate remark.
Usanas winced, awaiting the inevitable.
Hiss. I didn't mean to slander the memory of an honorable monster of legend.
Above, Antonina and Aeon turned to face each other.
You are certain, Antonina, asked the prince. You have your own difficult task ahead of you. My sovereign would be of help. I have the authority to use them any way I wish. As I told you, my father's offer is for a full alliance.
Antonina shook her head.
No, Aeon. The Negusinagast's offer we accept, certainly. Theodora gave me the authority to seek out that alliance myself, in fact. But if I can't establish my authority in Egypt with the Roman troops at my disposal, another 400 Aximite soldiers won't make the difference.
She cast a quick glance toward the Ethiopian warship. The craft was rolling gently in the waves just 100 yards away. The rail was lined with soldiers of the Daku and Sawe. There were, she estimated, about 50 of them. The rest of Aeon's troops were waiting for him at the small port of Pelusium, at the far eastern end of the Nile Delta. Besides, she added, the presence of Aksumite Sarwen would create political problems. I want to quell the ultra-Chalcedonian fanatics in Egypt without alienating the majority of Orthodox Greeks. You know they'll look on Ethiopians as allies of the Monophysites, foreign heretics used by the Empire against them. Thoughtfully, Aeon nodded. Antonina laid a friendly hand on his arm. So I must decline your offer, though I do thank you for it. Please pass those thanks on to your father. I will. Pass on to him also Rome's agreement to the proposed alliance. When she gets to Aksum, Irene can negotiate the details with the Negus and Agast. She is fully authorized to do so, and you may tell your father that she carries Empress Theodora's complete confidence. Providing an escort for her is the best use of your Sarwen at the moment. She broke into her own smile. And I'm happier this way. I hate sending Irene into that maelstrom in India, but at least I'll have the comfort of knowing she has you and Usanas and 400 Dekuan to protect her. Her shoulders shuddered just slightly. For that matter, I'll be happier knowing she doesn't have to face Red Sea pirates without... Pirates, growled Aeon. He barked a laugh. Behind him stood 3 officers of the Dekuan Sawe. Leaders of the prince's own royal regiment, they consider themselves, quite rightly, as elite soldiers. And seamen, for that matter. They match the prince's growl with their own glares, Aeon's barking laugh with their own sneers of derision. Pirates, they murmured. So might a pride of lions if they could mutter the word hyenas, or for that matter, elands, impalas. Meat. Antonina grinned. She gave the prince a warm embrace. He returned it, somewhat gingerly, in the way that a courteous and well-bred young royal returns the embrace of a respected, admired, and very voluptuous older woman. Be off, she whispered. Take care of Irene for me and for Theodora. And take care of yourself. A moment later, Aeon and his officers made their own easy and effortless descent into the skiff. Once they were aboard, the line was cast off and the boat began pulling away. The officers did their own rowing. In the Aksumite tradition, they had all risen from the ranks. They were accustomed to the task and did it with familiar expertise. Quickly, the skiff pulled toward the waiting Ethiopian warship. Antonina and Irene stared at each other for a time during that short voyage. Close friends, best friends, they had become during the past 3 years of joint work and struggle against the Mawa menace. Each of them now was taking her own route into the maw of the beast. In all likelihood, they would never see each other again. Antonina fought back her tears. God, I'll miss you, she whispered. So much. 30 yards away, she saw Irene turn her head aside. She didn't miss the slight sheen in those distant eyes. Irene, she knew, was fighting back her own tears. Antonina tore her gaze from the figure of her friend and stared at Aeon. The prince was sitting in the stern sheet of the skiff. Antonina could see his head slowly turning as he scanned the surface of the waves. Already, she realized, Aeon was fulfilling his promise to protect Irene from any danger. Then, seeing the arrogant ferocity lurking in Aeon's huge shoulders, she couldn't help smiling. She found great comfort in those shoulders. Sharks, of course, do not have shoulders. But if they did, so might a great shark confront the monsters of the sea. Tuna, squid, devil rays. Meat. By the time the skiff bearing Irene reached its destination, other skiffs were making their own way to the Aksumite warship from other Roman craft bearing their own cargoes. 3 of those skiffs carried barrels of gunpowder, 2 hauled cannons, brass 3-pounders, 1 in each skiff, and 2 more carried the small band of Syrian grenadiers and their wives and children who had volunteered to accompany Irene to India. Trainers, if all went well, for whatever forces the Empress Shakuntala might have succeeded in gathering around her. Trainers and their gear for the future gunpowder-armed rebellion of South India. Antonina's little hands gripped the rail. Her husband Belisarius, while he was in India, had done everything in his power to help create that rebellion. He was not a man to forget or abandon those he had sent in harm's way. Not my husband, she thought proudly, possessively. She didn't know the future, but Antonina would not have been surprised to learn that in humanity's future, any of those possible futures, the name of Belisarius would always be remembered for two things, if nothing else. Military brilliance, loyalty. She cast a last glance at the small and distant figure of her friend Irene and turned away from the rail. Then marched, to the bow of her own ship and stared across the waters of the Mediterranean. Stared to the southwest now, toward Alexandria. She gripped the rail again, and even more tightly. Silently, she made her vows. If Irene reached India safely, she wouldn't be stranded. If Belisarius's determination to support the Andhra rebellion was thwarted, it wouldn't be because Antonina failed her share of that task. She would take Alexandria and Egypt and reestablish the empire's rule. She would harness the skills and resources of that great province and turn it into the armory of Rome's war against Malwa. That armory, among other things, would be used to support Shakuntala and her rebels. Many of those guns would go south. Guns, cannons, rockets, gunpowder, and the men and women needed to use them and train others in their use. South to Aksum, then across the Erythraean Sea to Maharashtra. Somehow, some way, those weapons would find their way into the hands of the young empress whom Belisarius had freed from captivity. She clutched the rail, glaring at the still unseen people who would resist her will. The same people, the same type of people at least, who had sneered at her all her life. Had a shark in that moment caught sight of the small woman at the prow of the Roman warship, it would have recognized her. It would not have recognized the body, of course. Antonina's shapely form didn't even remotely resemble that of a fish, nor would its primitive brain have understood her intellect. But it would have known. Oh yes, its own instincts would have recognized a kindred spirit. Hungry. Want meat. Chapter 23. Mesopotamia, summer 531 AD. At Peroz Shapur, Belisarius ordered the first real break in the march since they had left Constantinople 3 months earlier. The army would rest in Peroz Shapur for 7 days, he announced. All the soldiers were given leave to enjoy the pleasures of the city, save only those assigned by all units on a rotating basis to serve as a military police force. After announcing this happy news before the assembled ranks of the army, Belisarius departed for his tent as quickly as possible. 10 minutes in the event, which was the time the troops spent cheering his name. He left it to Mars to make the savage, blood-curdling, and grisly warnings regarding the fate of any miscreant who transgressed the proper bounds of Persian hospitality. The army wasn't taken aback by Mars's slavering. His sadistic little monologue was even cheered, though not admittedly for 10 minutes. The grinning soldiers had no doubt that the threats would be made good. It was simply that the warnings were quite superfluous. Those soldiers were in a very good mood, as well they should be. First, there was the prospect of a week with no marching. Second, there was the prospect of spending that week in a large and well-populated city. The Persians had already arranged billeting. Beds, well, pallets at least. Finally, though rapturous joy, there was the delightful prospect of spending those days in a large and well-populated city when every single man in the army had money to burn. More money than most of them had ever seen in their lives, in fact. Between the Persian emperor's involuntary largesse, there might have been 3 ounces of gold left in the villa when the army departed, probably not, and the considerable booty of the destroyed Malwa army, Belisarius's little army was as flush as any army in history. They knew it, and the Persians in Peroz Shapur knew it too. The Roman soldiers would have been popular anyway, even if they had been penniless. Belisarius and his men had just scored the only great defeat for the Malwa since they began their invasion of Persia. And while Kurush and his 700 lancers received their fair share of the glory, most of it went to the arms of Rome. The citizens of Peroz Shapur had just been relieved of any immediate prospect of a siege, and the men who had eliminated that threat were also in position, literally overnight, to produce a massive infusion of cash into the city's coffers. Hail the conquering heroes! As the Romans marched into Peroz Shapur, the streets were lined with cheering Persians. Many of those were simply there to applaud. Others, Merchants, tavern keepers, prostitutes, jewelers, had additional motives. Simple, uncomplicated motives, which suited the simple and uncomplicated Roman troops to perfection. So, as he retired to his tent, Belisarius wasn't concerned that there would be any unfortunate incidents during the army's stay in Perovshahpur, which was good, because the general needed some time for himself, free of distraction. He wanted to think and examine a possibility. Burismenus visited him in his tent in mid-afternoon of the third day. "Why are you not staying in the city?" he asked after being invited within. The Sadaran glanced around at the austere living quarters which Belisarius always maintained on campaign. Other than an amphora of wine and the cooling breeze which blew in through the open flaps, the general's tent showed no signs of a man enjoying a well-deserved rest. Belisarius looked up from the pallet where he was sitting, half reclined against a cushion propped next to the chest which contained his personal goods. Smiling, he closed the book in his hand and gestured toward the chair at his little writing desk. The chair and the desk were the only items of furniture in the tent. "Have a seat, Burismenus. You look exhausted." The Persian nobleman, half collapsing on the chair, heaved a sigh. "I am exhausted. The city is a madhouse. People are carousing at every hour of the day and night." "Shamelessly and with wild abandon, I should imagine." The general grinned. "You can't get any sleep. You can't hear yourself think. To your astonishment, you find yourself remembering your tent with fond memories." Burismenus chuckled. "You anticipated this, I see." "I have no experience with Persian troops enjoying a celebration. Perhaps they're a subdued lot."
"Ha!"
"No?" Belisarius grinned. "But I do know what Roman soldiers are like. They'd drive the demons of the pit to mad distraction just from the noise alone." The general cocked his head. "There have been no serious problems, I trust." Burismenus shook his head. No. A slew of complaints from indignant matrons, of course, outraged at the conduct of their wanton daughters. But even they seem more concerned with the unfortunate consequences 9 months from now than with the impropriety of the moment. We Aryans frown on bastardy, you know." Belisarius smiled. "Every folk I know frowns on bastardy, and then somehow manages to cope with it." He scratched his chin. "A donation from the army, do you think? Discreet sort of thing, left in the proper hands after we depart? City notables, perhaps?" Burismenus considered the question. "Better the priesthood, I think." Then, shrugging, "The problem may not be a major one in any event. The matrons are more confused than angry. It seems any number of marriage proposals have been advanced, within a day of the army's arrival in some cases, and they don't know how to deal with them. As you may be aware, our customs in that respect are more involved than yours." As it happened, Belisarius was quite familiar with Persian marital traditions. Unlike the simple monogamy of Roman Christians, Persians recognized several different forms of marriage. The fundamental type, what they called patikhsaya, corresponded quite closely to the Christian marriage, except that polygamy was permissible. But other marriages were also given legal status in Persia, including one which was for a definite period only. Belisarius smiled. He was quite certain that his Syrian troops, with their long acquaintance with Medes, had passed on this happy knowledge to the other soldiers. His smile, after a moment, faded to a more thoughtful expression. "It occurs to me, Burismenus..." The Sardaran interrupted. His own face bore a pensive little smile. "Roman troops will be campaigning in Mesopotamia for quite some time. Years, possibly. Perovshahpur, because of its location, will be a central base, the central base, in all likelihood, for that military presence. Soldiers are men, not beasts. They will suffer from loneliness, many of them. A want in the heart as much as a lust in the body." Belisarius was struck again, as he had been many times before, by the uncanny similarity between the workings of his mind and that of the man sitting across from him in the tent. He was reminded of the odd friendship which had developed between him and Rana Sangha while he had been in India. There also, differences in birth and breeding had been no barrier, even though Sangha was his sworn enemy. For a moment he wondered how the Rajput king was faring in his campaign in Bactria. "All too well, I suspect," came the rueful thought. "Yet I cannot help wishing the man good fortune, in his life at least, if not his purpose." He brought his thoughts back to the matter at hand. I think we can make a suitable arrangement, Beresmenus. Talk to your priesthood, would you? If they're willing to be cooperative, I will encourage my soldiers to approach their romantic liaisons with a more, what shall I call it? The Sardaran grinned.
Long-term approach, he suggested.
Or, for those who are incorrigibly low-minded,
guaranteed recreation.
Beresmenus stroked his beard. The gesture positively exuded satisfaction. A well-groomed man by temperament, he had taken advantage of the stay in Perosia Poor to have the beard properly trimmed and shaped. But some of his pleasure obviously stemmed from the prospective solution of a problem. A minor problem now, but small tensions uncorrected have a way of festering.
Yes,
yes, he mused. I foresee no problems from the Mazda priests, even less from the matrons. It is in every Persian's interest to avoid the shame of illegitimacy, after all. The absence of a legal father is a small thing to explain, especially if there is a subsidy for the child. He eyed the general a bit skeptically. Understanding the look, Belisarius shrugged. The subsidy isn't a problem. The army is rich. Well over half of that booty is in my personal possession. Much of it is my personal share. The rest is in my trust as a fund for the disabled, along with widows and orphans. Between the two, there's plenty to go around.
And your soldiers?
I can't promise you that all of them will act responsibly, Beresmenus. I don't share the commonly held opinion that soldiers have the morals of street cats, mind you, but I'm hardly about to hold them up as models of rectitude, either. Many of my troops won't care in the slightest what bastards they leave behind them, even leaving aside the ones who like to boast about it. But I will spread the word. If my commanders support me, which they will... He paused for an instant, savoring the words.
Which they will... Oh, yes. I have my army now.
Then the soldiers will begin to develop their own customs. Armies tend to be conservative. If taking a Persian wife while on campaign in Mesopotamia, a wife of convenience, perhaps, but a wife nonetheless, becomes ingrained in their habits, they'll frown on their less reputable comrades. Bad thing, being frowned on by your mates. He gave Beresmenus his own skeptical eye. You understand, of course, that many of those soldiers will already have a wife back home, and that any Persian wife will not be recognized under Roman law. Beresmenus laughed.
Please, Belisarius.
He waved his hand in a grand gesture of dismissal. What do we pure-blood Aryans care about the superstitious rituals of foreign barbarians practiced in their far-off and distant lands?
The thought came from Aid. Thou hast committed fornication.
But that was in another country, and besides, the wench is not Patixaya.
It's from a future poet,
a bit hesitantly.
It's appropriate, though, isn't it?
Belisarius was astonished. He had never seen Aid exhibit such a subtle grasp of the intricacies of human relationships. The jewel exuded quiet pride. Belisarius began to send a congratulatory thought when his attention was drawn away by Beresmenus's next words.
What are you reading?
Belisarius glanced down at the book in his lap. For a moment he was confused, caught between his interrupted dialogue with Aid and Beresmenus's idle query. But his attention almost immediately focused on the question. To Beresmenus, the matter had been simply one of polite curiosity. To Belisarius, it was not. As a matter of fact, I was meaning to speak to you about it. He held up the volume. It's by a Roman historian named Ammianus Marcellinus. This volume contains books 20 through 25 of his Rerum Gesterum. I am not familiar with the man. One of the ancients? A contemporary of Livy or Polybius? Belisarius shook his head. Much more recent than that. Ammianus was a soldier, actually. He accompanied Emperor Julian on his expedition into Persia 2 centuries ago. He tapped the book on his lap. This volume contains his memoirs of the episode.
Ah.
The Sardaran's face exhibited an odd combination of emotions.
Shame. Satisfaction.
The thing began badly for us, true, he murmured. Most of the towns we just marched through, Anatha, for instance, were destroyed by Julian. So was Perosia Poor, now that I think about it, burnt to a shell. In the end, however... Satisfaction reigned supreme. Belisarius chuckled. In the end, that damn fool Julian burned his boats in one of those histrionic gestures you'll ever see me doing. He snorted, a professional deriding the flamboyant excesses of an admittedly talented amateur. The man won practically every battle he fought and every siege he undertook, and then, God save us from theatrical commanders, stranded his army without a supply line, marched them to surrender from starvation after losing his own life. He shook his head. Talk about snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Yes, it ended well for you Persians. You got Nisibis and five other provinces in ransom for allowing the Romans to march out of Mesopotamia. The satisfaction on Barrasimenes's face ebbed. Not so well as all that, my friend. The towns were still destroyed and the countryside ravaged. He rubbed his scarred shoulder pensively. In the end, it was just another of the endless wars which Arians and Greeks seem obsessed with fighting. How many times has Nisibis changed hands over the centuries? You have sacked Ctesiphon and we Antioch. Is either empire the better for it? Belisarius shook his head. No, Barrasimenes. I, for one, would like to see an end to the thing. A crooked smile. Mind you, I suppose I could be accused of unworthy motives. Ending a millennium-long conflict with a victory at Minduus, I mean. Still rubbing his shoulder, Barrasimenes smiled. I will allow you that personal triumph, Belisarius. Quite cheerfully. I hope never to meet Romans in a field of battle again. Belisarius laughed. I too. You Persians are just too damn tough. He eyed the Sauteron slyly. That was Justinian's main argument for accepting your proposals, you know. He said that making 100 years' peace would cement the Roman army's allegiance to the dynasty. Anything to avoid another clash with those damn Persian Dagons. Barrasimenes, for all his scholarly nature, was too much of a Dagon himself not to be pleased. But he didn't linger over the gratification. He pointed at the book. Why are you reading it, then? Belisarius scratched his chin. I brought it with me. Borrowed it from a bibliophile friend named Irene. Just on speculation, I thought it might contain some useful material. As it happens, I think it does. Quite useful, in fact. He gave Barrasimenes an amused look. Have you had enough rest and relaxation in Perosiapur? Does the thought of 2 days' travel in the countryside appeal to you? It'll be scorching hot, of course. On the other hand, there will be certain subtle pleasures. You know, things like quiet, solitude, serenity. Enough, laughed Barrasimenes. Anything to get away from this insane revelry. The bleakest desert in the world sounds like paradise to me at the moment. It won't be all that bad, actually. I just want to retrace our route. Go back up the river to the old canal we passed by on our way here. Barrasimenes frowned. The Nahar Malka? The Royal Canal? Belisarius nodded. The Sauteron's puzzlement deepened. Whatever for? That canal's as dry as a bone. It hasn't been used since... He stopped. Belisarius completed the thought. Since you Persians blocked it off 2 centuries ago. After the Roman Emperor Julian used it to float his ships from the Euphrates to the Tigris in order to besiege Ctesiphon. Barrasimenes blew out his cheeks. Yes, yes, that little episode. Not so little, actually. Julian failed to take Ctesiphon, but it was a close thing. Anyway, after that, we decided the irrigation and trading value of the canal wasn't worth the risk of providing Romans with a perfect logistics route to attack our capital. He cocked his head quizzically. But still, I ask again, why are you interested in a canal which is empty of water? That's precisely the reason I am interested in it, Barrasimenes. He held up his hand, forestalling further questions. Please. At the moment, I am simply engaged in idle speculation brought on by reading an old book. Before I say anything else, I need to look at the thing. I wasn't able to examine it closely on our way into Perosiapur. Barrasimenes rose. As you will. When do you wish to depart? Tomorrow morning, as early as possible. A little frown appeared on his brow. I hate to drag any of my troops away from their celebration, but we'll need an escort. Some of my Bucellarii will just have to... No, Belisarius, leave the lads to their pleasures. My household troops have been awaiting me here for almost a month. We can take our escort from among their ranks. I insist. To Belisarius' surprise, the expedition which set out the next morning turned out to be quite a major affair. A full 2,000 of Boresminus's household troops showed up outside his tent at the crack of dawn. Even if he hadn't already been awake, the sound of those horses would have tumbled him from his pallet. Half expecting a surprise cavalry raid, the general emerged from his tent with sword in hand. After dismounting, Boresminus grinned at the Roman general's wide-eyed stare.
"It seems I am not the only one who seeks a bit of peace and quiet," he remarked. "Almost all of my household troops clamored to join the expedition once the word got out, but I didn't think we needed 6,000 men."
6,000? Asked Belisarius.
The Sauteron's cheerful grin widened.
"Amazing, isn't it? I was expecting 3,000 at the most. It seems the news of our great victory at the Battle of Anatha has caused Dagon's to spring up from the very soil, desperately seeking to share in the glory. Truth is, I think it was the faint hope that we might encounter another party of Malwa raiders that inspired this great outpouring of enthusiasm for our little expedition."
One of the general's servants approached, leading his horse. As he took the reins, Belisarius remarked, "They're not all troops from your household, then?" The Sauteron gave his shoulders a little insouciant shake.
"Who's to say? The majority are from my province of Garamig. The rest, who knows? Most of them, I suspect, are from Ormazd's own province of Arbaistan."
Belisarius nodded and mounted his horse. As they began to ride off, he mulled over Boresminus's last words. For all their similarities, there were some important differences in the way the Roman and Persian empires were organized. One of those differences, a key difference, was in their military structure. The Roman army was a professional army supplemented by mercenary auxiliaries, usually, though not always, drawn from barbarian tribes. The Persian army, on the other hand, was a much more complicated phenomenon.
"Feudalism is always complicated," came Aide's interjection. "Most convoluted system we humans have ever come up with, and we're a convoluted folk, especially you protoplasmic types."
"So it is," murmured Belisarius. He didn't inquire as to the meaning of protoplasmic. He suspected he didn't want to know. Each nobleman of Sauteron and Vuzurgan rank maintained a private army made up of soldiers from their province or district. Some of those, the household troops, were financially supported by their lord. The rest were Dagons, whose obligation to provide military service was a more nebulous affair. The Dagons were village and small town knights, essentially, the lowest rank in the aristocracy, but still part of what Arians called the Azadan. Although they were officially under the command of the higher nobility, the Dagons were economically independent and not, as a class, given to subservience. When it came to rallying the support of his Dagons, a high lord's prestige counted for more than formal obligation. For their part, each Dagon maintained a small body of retainers who would accompany him on campaign. Not more than a handful, usually. Well-respected men of their village or town, prosperous farmers and blacksmiths in the main, who had not only the strength, fitness, and skill to serve as armored archers, but could afford the horse and gear as well. The Persian emperor himself, beyond his own household troops, directly commanded nothing but his personal bodyguard, a regiment of men who still bore the ancient title of the Immortals. For the rest, the Shahanshah depended on the support of the great nobility, who in turn depended on the support of the Dagons. In theory, it was all very neatly pyramidal. In practice, Aide summed it up nicely. "Victory has a multitude of fathers. Defeat is an orphan. Or in this case, victory has a multitude of would-be sons." Belisarius smiled. "And defeat is childless." He twisted in his saddle, passing the smile onto Boresminus.
"You think Ormad's joints are aching, then?"
The Sauteron chuckled.
"I suspect that Ormazd right now is feeling very much like a victim of arthritis. Each morning when he wakes up, he finds his army has shrunk a bit more. While faithless Dagons disappear, seeking fame and fortune in more likely quarters."
Belisarius studied the huge escort which surrounded them. The Persians were marching in good order, although to a Roman general's eye, the formation seemed a bit odd. After a moment, he realized that the peculiar lumpiness was due to the formation's social order. Rather than marching in Roman ranks and files, the Persians tended to cluster in small groups. retainers accompanying their Dagans, he realized.
Where the basic unit of the Roman army was a squad, that of the Persian force was a village band. Men who had grown up together and known each other all their lives.
After a minute or so, Belisarius found himself deep in a rumination over the most effective way to combine Roman and Persian forces, given each people's habits and characteristics. He shook off the thoughts for now. He had something more immediate to attend to.
"We need to make a stop at the prisoners' camp," he announced. Beresmanus raised a questioning eyebrow but made no protest. He simply called out a name. Immediately, one of the Persians riding nearby trotted his horse over to the Sardaran and the Roman general. As soon as he arrived, Beresmanus made a little sweeping gesture with his hand.
"I would like to introduce the commander of my household troops, General Belisarius. Marina is his name, from a fine Azadan family affiliated to the Suren."
Belisarius nodded politely. The Persian commander returned the nod very stiffly. Examining him, Belisarius wasn't sure if the stiffness was inherent in the man himself or was due to the specific circumstances. A bit of both, he decided. As a rule, in his experience, Persians tended toward a certain athletic slenderness. Marina, on the other hand, was a large man, almost as heavy-set as Belisarius's friend Sittis. But where Sittis handled his weight and girth with a certain sprawling ease, Marina seemed to prefer a far more immobile method. For all the man's obvious horsemanship, he sat his saddle almost like a statue. Beresmanus passed on the command to visit the prisoners' camp on the way north. Marina nodded, again very stiffly, and trotted away to give the orders.
"Not the most informal sort of fellow," remarked Belisarius.
Beresmanus's lips twisted.
"Normally he is not so rigid and proper, but I think he is unsure of how to manage the current situation. This is not actually the first time you and he were introduced, in a manner of speaking."
Belisarius pursed his lips.
"He too was at Minduus."
It was a statement more than a question.
"Oh yes. Right by my side during Firuz's mad charge. He tried to come to my aid after a lance spilled me from my horse. But he was disabled himself by a plumbata right through the thigh."
Belisarius winced. The plumbata was the weapon which modern Roman infantrymen used in place of the pilum, the javelin favored in the earlier days of the empire. The plumbata was a much shorter weapon, more like a dart than a throwing spear, but what it lost in range it gained in penetrating power, due to the heavy lead weight fitted to the shaft below the spear point. At close range, hurled with the underarm motion of an expert, it could penetrate even the armor of Cataphrax or Dagans. The wounds it produced were notoriously brutal.
"Pinned him right to the saddle," continued Beresmanus. "Then, when his horse was hamstrung and gutted, the beast rolled over on top of him, almost took off his leg. Would have, I'm sure, if he were a smaller man. He still walks with a terrible limp."
The general's wince turned into a grimace. Seeing the expression, Beresmanus shrugged.
"He doesn't bear you any ill will, Belisarius. Ill will over that battle, of course, he has in plenty, but all of it is directed toward Firuz. Still, he doesn't exactly count you among his bosom companions."
"I imagine not." The general hesitated for a moment, then deciding that politeness was overridden by necessity. "I must know, however, please don't take offense, if he will be able to serve properly, being forced in such close—"
"Have no fear on that score," interrupted Beresmanus. "Whatever his attitude may be towards you, there is not the slightest doubt of his feelings for me and my family."
Belisarius's face must have exhibited a certain skepticism, for the Sardaran immediately added,
"It isn't simply a matter of duty and tradition. Marina's family is noted, even famed, for its military accomplishments, but they're not rich. He would still be in captivity had I not paid his ransom out of my own funds."
Belisarius nodded. He and Beresmanus rode together in silence for a minute. Then the Sardaran remarked, almost idly,
"I have noted that you yourself are quite generous to your Bucellarii. I was told that you dispense a full half of your battle-gained treasure to them, in fact. Most munificent indeed."
Belisarius smiled crookedly.
"That's quite true. My retainers are sworn to my service anyway, of course, but I'm a practical man. Men are not tools, mind you. Still, a blacksmith takes good care of the implements of his trade, keeps them clean, sharp, and well-oiled."
Silence fell upon them again as they neared the prisoners' camp.
A very companionable silence between two men who understood each other quite well. It was Belisarius's first visit to the camp since the army had reached Peroz-Shapur. He was pleased to see that his Bucellarii had carried out his instructions to the letter. Marina was riding alongside Beresminus as they entered. His eyebrows lifted. "This is a prisoner's camp?" he asked. To all outward appearances, the place looked like any other Roman field encampment. The tents, the multitude of tents, no crowding men like hogs in a pen here, were arranged in neat rows and files. Latrines had been dug to the proper depth and at the proper distance from the tents themselves. The campfires were large and well supplied, both with fuel and with cooking implements. By the time they arrived, all 2,000 Kushans were standing in the open ground between the tents. They had heard the horses coming, naturally, and while the sound of those hooves hadn't been those of an attacking force, still, why 2,000 cavalrymen? Seeing the alert and ready stance of those unarmed men, Marina grunted his approval.
Good, good, staunch fellows. Be a massacre, of course, but at least they wouldn't die from back wounds.
At the entrance to the camp, they were greeted by a small contingent of Roman soldiers. A mixed unit, this, made up of men from all the forces under Belisarius's command, serving their assigned rotation in the duty of guarding the prisoners. The very unwanted duty, needless to say, while their comrades were cavorting in Peroz-Shapur. But Belisarius could detect no signs of resentment or bitterness. The men knew that the rotation would be faithfully followed. In a day or so, they too would be enjoying the fleshpots, while others took their appointed turn. Fairly apportioned in Belisarius's army, the duties as well as the rewards. Of that, his men were by now quite satisfied. To the general's surprise and sheer delight, the commander of that detachment proved to be Basil, the man who led his contingent of Katyusha rocket chariots. Before leaving on the expedition, Belisarius had toyed with the idea of summoning Basil to go along, but he had dropped the notion, assuming that the man would be well-nigh impossible to find in the Saturnalia at Peroz-Shapur. Yet here he was, one of the two men, three or four, perhaps, that he most wanted to accompany him. "You'll be going with me, Basil," he announced. "We're taking a little surveying party to that old canal we passed on our way in." He glanced over his shoulder at the huge mass of Persian cavalrymen waiting outside the camp. "Well, not all that little. But I need your expertise. You've had more practical experience handling gunpowder than I have." Basil didn't seem sulky at the news, even though it would mean that the Hecatontarch would have to forgo his own turn at the pleasures of Peroz-Shapur. Belisarius wasn't surprised. He had personally selected Basil for his new post, after going over every possibility with Morris at great length. Both of them had settled on Basil, partly for the man's apparent comfort around gunpowder, which wasn't typical of most of the Thracian cataphracts, even more, however, for his reliability.
"Yes, sir. When do we leave?"
"Within minutes, I hope, as soon as I can collect a Kushan or two. Where's Vasu?"
"Never mind, I see him."
The commander of the Kushans was trotting toward them, accompanied by a handful of his top subordinates. Once he reached the general, Vasudeva gazed up at the man on horseback. There was no expression on his face at all.
"Is there a problem, General?"
Belisarius smiled cordially, shaking his head.
"Not in the least, Vasudeva. I'm simply on my way to investigate a nearby ruin. Less than a day's ride away, as it happens. I came here because I would like one or two Kushans to come along."
No expression.
"Me, I assume."
Still no expression. Belisarius, on the other hand, grinned from ear to ear. "Of course not, Vasudeva. That would look terrible, I think, taking the prisoner's commander off on a mysterious trip, from which, judging from all too many sad histories, he might never return. No, no, what I want is the Kushan soldier, or soldiers, if there's more than one, who is most familiar with..." He groped for the word. There was no equivalent in Kushan, so far as he knew, for the Roman term engineering. He settled on an awkward makeshift. "Field architecture, water-moving works,
Vasudeva nodded. "You are an expert in siegecraft."
"Yes, well put." For the first time, Vasudeva's mask slipped a bit. A hint of bitterness came into his face.
"For that, General, you could pick almost any Kushan at random. We are all experts. The Malwa are fond of using us for siege work. Up until the victory, of course.
Then we are allowed to bind our wounds while the Yetai and the Kshatriyas enjoy the plunder. The mask returned. However, Vasudeva turned his head, looking toward one of the men by his side. Vima, you go. You're probably the best. The Kushan named Vima nodded. He began to move toward one of the saddled but riderless horses which Belisarius had brought with him into the camp. Then, apparently struck by a thought, he paused. A question, General Belisarius. You said water moving works. Is this, whatever we are going to see, is it connected with irrigation? Belisarius nodded. Vima glanced at the three extra horses. Two more, all right? He asked. Again, Belisarius nodded. Vima scanned the large crowd of Kushans who by now were gathered about. Cadphises, he called out. You come. And where's Huvishka? A man shouldered his way to the front. Here, he announced. Vima gestured. You also. Once Belisarius and his party emerged from the prisoners' camp and began heading up the road north from Piroz-Shapur, Vima issued a little sigh. Nice to ride a horse again, he commented. Then, eyeing Belisarius, I don't suppose this is an omen of things to come. Belisarius shook his head a bit apologetically. No, Vima, if we find what I hope to find, I'm afraid you Kushans are in for a long stint of very hard labor in one of the hottest places in the world. Vima grunted. So did the two Kushans riding beside him. Could be worse, mused the one called Huvishka. Much worse, agreed Cadphises. Vima grunted. Curious, Belisarius inquired. You are not displeased at the prospect? All three Kushans grunted in unison. The sound, oddly, was one of amusement. We Kushans tend to approach things from the bottom up, General, remarked Vima. The long stint of whatever kind of labor sounds distinctly better than many alternative prospects. Cadphises grunted. Huvishka interpreted. Being executed, for instance,